Today's broadcast originally aired on January 20th, 2025, Inauguration Day.
Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun.
I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, people-powered radio in L.A., and coast to coast and around the globe on dozens of affiliate stations, both terrestrial and streaming across the internets. This is the Bradcast 2025 Inauguration Counter-Programming Special. In many ways, as it turns out, it is not all that different from our 2017 Inauguration Counter-Programming Special. I'm Brand Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. And if you're looking for coverage of Donald Trump's second inauguration as president of these United States, well, this is not it. Or is it?
That brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
One of the great things about our democracy is it expresses itself in all sorts of ways, and that includes people protesting. I've been the subject of protests during the course of my 8 years, and I suspect that there's not a president in our history that at some point hasn't been subject to these protests. So I would not advise people who feel strongly or are concerned about some of the issues that have been raised during the course of the campaign, I wouldn't advise them to be silent. What I would advise, what I advised before the election and what I will continue to advise after the election, is that elections matter, voting matters, organizing matters, being informed on the issues matter. And what I consistently say to young people, I say it in the United States, but I'll say it here in Germany and across Europe. Do not take for granted our systems of government and our way of life.
I'm Timothy Snyder. I'm a historian. I've written some books. Lesson number one is do not obey in advance. Most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. So this is the first lesson because it's about the basic choice we make when we confront difficulty. It's about the choice of all choices. Are we going to go with the new flow, or are we going to stand, if only a little bit, only hesitantly, as long as we can, against the current? A second little idea, which was very important to this lesson, has to do with time. It has to do with not putting things off. Because one thing you do when you do not obey in advance, one thing you do when you recognize a situation as abnormal, is that you're laying down a marker. You're laying down a marker in time. You're saying, from this point forward, I'm not going along. And this is very important, because the longer you wait before laying down your marker, the harder it's going to become. The longer you just let things go, the more you're going to be tempted by the new normal. The more you're going to use a bad word, normalize. The more you're going to use your own moral, psychological, social resources to make the negative changes around you seem normal to you and normal to everyone else. And this, of course, is what has happened. Not to a few, not to a few thousand, not to a few hundred thousand, but to millions and millions and millions of Americans since 2016. There are plenty of things that happened during the Trump administration where, if we had made a list and said, would you tolerate that? Would you tolerate the president endorsing the Russian intelligence services over his own? Would you tolerate a president being impeached because he asked a foreign country to intervene in our elections? The list goes on and on. The point is that if we'd asked people this in 2016, they would have said, no, of course, I'd be outraged. But when you go along with one thing, then you'll tend to go along with the next thing. And here comes the rub. If you do obey in advance, if you do normalize, then you become morally, psychologically, socially committed to all the things that happen. And because you never investigated, you never took a stand, you never asserted your own idea of normal, you're going to be all the more committed to these things. You're going to feel all the more defensive. You're going to be all the more likely to argue, to quarrel, even to engage in acts of violence. So this is why it's always so important not to obey in advance.
We will never give up. We will never concede. We're going to walk down to the Capitol and we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
The 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. If you haven't introduced yourself, here's something of an introduction. Section 3 specifically is about disqualification from office, and it so reads.
No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. Meaning, if someone had sworn an oath to support the Constitution,
like serving as per dictator,
and then took part in rebellion,
like Jan 6,
or helped the enemy,
like giving aid and comfort to
They
as in criminal Trump,
were banned from holding positions in the government. Though Congress can remove this ban with a 2/3 vote, which in this case, should members of Congress
even think about doing this, would be a betrayal of their oaths of office.
He's an adjudicated insurrectionist. You need not know anything else. He's an adjudicated insurrectionist.
as Section 3 of the 14th Amendment lays out. This is not, as our lawmakers have said so many times, optional. The Constitution is not optional. I've spent the past year and a half, and especially the past month, laser focused on Section 3. I covered this case, the Colorado case that went up through the Supreme Court, extensively with the lawyers at CRU. And one conclusion that they have all reached, in spite of the ruling in Trump v. Anderson, is that Donald Trump remains an adjudicated insurrectionist. This man is a domestic terrorist. He is constitutionally disqualified from holding office. And so to think that we are about to pass the Rubicon into this extra constitutional territory when our lawmakers have the not only the ability, but the obligation to stop this man from assuming this office is a moment that we absolutely have to take stock of. And I've been trying to get people to call Congress, trying to get them to sign petitions. And I know that the appetite is not there. And that is why I came to the point that we had to put our bodies peacefully in DC to pressure them to say, this is the moment in history when it must be done. All of the dire, horrible, awful, destructive consequences that are coming to our democracy and the free world are going to lay on your shoulders. One of the excuses they're giving to their constituents, because I've seen it in letters that have been sent back to them, is that we are committed to a peaceful transfer of power. Well, isn't that one hell of a straw man argument? Because this is in defense of a peaceful transfer of power that we would object to the certification of the electoral votes of an adjudicated insurrectionist.
No matter who you are, you have the First Amendment right to peacefully assemble and protest in public spaces, and photograph and videotape the police or anything else in a public space. Here's the deal. Public spaces include streets, sidewalks, and public parks. Private property owners can set rules for public entry, like a theater saying no cell phones. The right to take photos does not give you the right to go places you're not otherwise allowed, record audio of other people's private conversations, trespass, or interfere with police engaged in legitimate law enforcement operations. Police officers may not confiscate or demand to view your digital photos or videos without a warrant, or delete your photos or videos under any circumstances. If you're stopped or detained for taking photos, be polite. Don't resist. Ask, "Am I free to go?" If the officer says no, you are being detained. And if you are detained, ask what crime you're suspected of committing. Until you ask to leave, being stopped is considered voluntary. Remind the officer that taking photographs is your First Amendment right and does not constitute reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. If you believe any right listed here has been violated, contact your local ACLU. Know your rights.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. In this document, look for the words. Look for the words liberty and equal protection of law. Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing, and no one. We cannot solve our problems by building walls.
Like many Americans, I have spent the last 12 hours refreshing the Canadian immigration website, which keeps crashing. So I am panicking because melanin doesn't rub off. But look, Donald Trump won. We got to take the L. He spoke to people who felt ignored by Washington and wanted their jobs back. And I understand. I don't quite get how you get there by electing a guy who collects bankruptcies the way Michael Jordan collects rings. But okay, they deserve to be heard, and last night we heard them. But I can't forget something else I heard. On December 7, 2015, Donald Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. I remember that date because it's the birthday of the worst day of my life. Seriously, how is that not instantly disqualifying? Even if that's not why most people voted for him, open racism should just be a deal breaker. You personally may not be a racist, sexist, xenophobe, but that comes with the package, right? Like if a car comes with heated seats, you may not want them, but you'll take them.
Yeah, but then if the seats go, hey, don't sit on me, camel jockey.
You should be like, hey, I don't want the car.
Makes sense.
So if you take that deal, what you're telling me is, hey, man, I don't hate you. I just don't care about you.
I hear you, Hassan. I hear you. But Islamophobia in America is nothing new. You've encountered this many, many times since 9/11.
Have I pretended to be Puerto Rican a few times since 9/11? Glad dog is he. But it used to be when I walked on a plane, I could feel the stares and suspicion, and it sucked. But at least I knew the president of the United States had my back, mostly because he's also a Muslim. We can say it now. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He's Muslim, okay? Who gives a shit? But now, that C-21B calling the flight attendant, trying to get me thrown off the plane. Now that guy is the president. Plus, I also think he's groping the lady sitting next to him. And look, I don't want people thinking like, oh, that poor little Muslim boy, that little brown boy, your life is tough. No, it's all of us. It's not just Muslims or Mexicans or African Americans. It is all of us, whether it's your citizenship, marriage rights, freedom of speech. Donald Trump is going to move on them like a bitch.
That was his line. You just quoted his line.
Yeah,
that's what he said. You know, though, there is a chance. And I know it's weird to say this. There is a chance that maybe he'll end up being more moderate.
Oh, diet xenophobia, that's cool. Low-calorie racism, like what? This is a true story. My mom is out of the country right now. She's visiting my grandma. And she's a US citizen, she's lived here 30 years. She's on the phone with me last night, and she's like, Hassan, I don't know if I can come back until February. Am I gonna be able to get back into the country? And the fact that I can't tell her yes with 100% certainty is heartbreaking. And there are a lot of people telling me, hey man, don't worry. Trump's not really gonna ban all Muslims, but I don't know, man. That is my mom. And I need her back home because I love her and she owes me $300.
This is the Bradcast's 2025 Inauguration Counter Programming Special. We'll be back.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
But if you close your eyes, does it almost feel like nothing changed at all? And if you close your eyes...
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com, and this is the Bradcast 2025 Inauguration Counter Programming Special.
All day yesterday, I was walking around proudly wearing my I voted sticker. Today, I wore my I am questioning my fundamental belief in the goodness of humanity sticker. Yeah, they give those out. They give those out at the bake sale. Right outside. Now, as a late night host, people often say to me, come on, part of you has got to want Trump to win because he gives you so much material to work with. No, no. No one tells the guy who cleans the bathroom, wow, you must love it when someone has explosive diarrhea. There's so much material for you to work with.
Come on. We are looking at count one, guilty. Count two, guilty.
13, 14, guilty.
Count 20, guilty.
Count 27, guilty.
Listen, it's a unanimous jury verdict, unanimous on all counts.
I'm totally innocent. I did nothing wrong. They talked about business records, and the business records were extremely accurately counted. I had nothing to do with them. Anyway, that was done by an accountant or a bookkeeper who I think gave very credible testimony and was corroborated by everybody that was asked. I got indicted over calling a legal expense. I won the election in a massive landslide, and I just like to exclaim that I was treated very, very unfairly.
Far from expressing any kind of remorse for his criminal conduct, the defendant has purposefully bred disdain for our judicial institutions and the rule of law. He has been unrelenting in his unsubstantiated attacks upon this court and its family, individual prosecutors and their families, the witnesses, the grand jury, the trial jury, and the justice system as a whole. As this court has noted, the defendant's conduct, quote, constitutes a direct attack on the rule of law itself. Put simply, this defendant has caused enduring damage to public perception of the criminal justice system and has placed officers of the court in harm's way.
Never before has this court been presented with such a unique and remarkable set of circumstances. To be clear, the protections afforded the office of the president are not a mitigating factor. They do not reduce the seriousness of the crime or justify its commission in any way. One power they do not provide is the power to erase a jury verdict. It is clear from legal precedent, which until July 1st was scarce, that Donald Trump, the ordinary citizen, Donald Trump, the criminal defendant, would not be entitled to such considerable protections. After careful analysis, in obedience to governing mandates, and pursuant to the rule of law, this court has determined that the only lawful sentence that permits entry of a judgment of conviction without encroaching upon the highest office in the land is an unconditional discharge. I impose that sentence to cover all 34 counts. Sir, I wish you Godspeed as you assume your second term in office.
Godspeed as you assume the second term in office. Words that have never been spoken in any courtroom in American history. It is a somber closing to one chapter. It also is a statement of where we are at. And the law was finally applied to Trump in one of his four cases. Most first-time offenders in these business cases don't get jail time anyway. But many get some other punishment, including a probation, even a home confinement, community service. So while sparing jail is common, the unconditional discharge today was actually unusual, legal experts calling it incredibly rare. And so this outcome, if you're following it, is something of a split decision. On the one hand, New York's DA went first, taking action, creating a precedent for prosecuting a former president, which had literally never been done before. And that took on great pressure. And then he went forward and won the case, convicting Donald Trump. On the other hand, the trial ended up showcasing the ways that Donald Trump could break rules, evade more serious accountability. He infamously attacked the judge's family. You heard the prosecutor refer to that. He repeatedly broke the gag order. Those are things that other defendants would have definitely, and we have the examples, we have the history, faced stricter punishment for. Now, there are other observers who ask, all right, does any of this matter after the electorate returned now President-elect Trump to power? That's an understandable question. And if you look at it politically, it's clearly a matter of disappointment or frustration for many of Trump's foes. But let me tell you something. I was down inside that courtroom. I watched then defendant, now felon Trump in that very case and watch the witnesses and watch the jury. And let me tell you something about that concern. Well, does it even matter if he was reelected? In our system, that is and is supposed to be legally irrelevant. The rule of law, when it works, transcends public and political pressures and is certainly not intended to shape them. Indeed, there's a funny thing that's happening here where you hear an overlap from what convict Donald Trump said today in his court proceeding and what some critics and political foes of Donald Trump say. They actually overlap. The critics saying what I just sort of referred to. Does it even matter? He won anyway. And him, felon Trump, saying he won and this was designed to hurt him and he won with votes despite this whole effort. But that's exactly backwards because that's the obsessively political lens. He was caught and the law took hold and a jury of his peers weighed the evidence not to shape or impact the election, should never be that way, but rather to go forward with the legal process separate from any election. The defendant, or in this case, convict's popularity is never supposed to be the point, the purpose, or the object. And remember, while it may be easy to forget now, or it's in sort of the fog of a very, very long set of couple of years involving all of this and sort of the interregnum between these two Trump terms, there was a long road with dogged reporting, a heck of a lot of people standing up, and a lot of litigation to ever get the rule of law to hold and ultimately get to Trump's guilty verdict. And if you broaden out, today is another long-awaited, long, hard-earned legal marker that reinforces how Trump's enterprises are riddled with documented crimes. You see the felon at the top as of today, but from his first campaign to his business to his 2020 campaign, so many people in so many places and jurisdictions convicted. That's not a witch hunt. Legally, if you use that terminology, it's just a lot of witches.
So I know that for many people, today was disappointing, that they had expected more justice when it came to Donald Trump. And I appreciate that. And in some ways, I share that view. But I'm beginning to develop a much more optimistic outlook. I'm beginning to look at today as a real low in our country's history. The incoming president has just been sentenced. He is a convicted felon. He will be a convicted felon when he is sworn in. And despite the incredible power that he will hold, in a Manhattan courtroom, a judge and prosecutor stood up and held him accountable nonetheless. It may not be a full measure of justice, but it is accountability. They stuck it out. They made sure that the jury's verdict, that the conviction stuck. That was not always a preordained conclusion. And Judge Merchan took deliberate, clear steps to make sure that the Supreme Court would rule the way that they did. This discharge that many people are up in arms about that permitted Trump to walk out of court or to at least walk off of the Zoom, a free man with no further obligation to the court, that was what caused the Supreme Court to render this very narrow 5-4 decision. This tells us the rule of law can still work. It's fractured. It is under attack. It is going to be a tough 4 years, but we are Americans and we can do it. This was a case that preceded Trump's election. It's the origin story of his presidency, an origin that began in crime. The presidency proceeded as it began. The truth still matters.
And I've heard a lot this evening about democratic principles, civic engagement. And I guess I'm wondering, Justice Souter, if you could share with us your thoughts about what the appropriate role and probably responsibility as well of our schools to produce civically engaged students.
I'll start with the bottom line. I don't believe there is any problem of American politics and American public life which is more significant today than the pervasive civic ignorance of the Constitution of the United States and the structure of government. I hope every one of you runs for the legislature.
The
I won't spend a lot of time on statistics. We know with pretty reliable evidence that two-thirds of the people in the United States do not know that we have three separate branches of government. I remember, and I don't know the name of it, but I can remember hearing about a survey back 4 or 5 years ago in which a substantial percentage of Americans believed that the Supreme Court of the United States was a committee of the Congress. It didn't used to be this bad. When I was in school, we had, actually, in the course of high school, there were two required civics courses. When we got out of high school, we may not have known a lot, but we at least had a basic understanding of the structure of American government, the structure of state government, for that matter. And what that gave us was not only a kind of a framework to hang the other thing, hang on the things that we learned later. It gave us a basic sense of where responsibility lies for given problems within the government. And a corollary of that was we certainly understood where responsibility lay in matters that with the business of the legislative branch or the Congress of the United States. And we knew that we could influence that by voting. Today, I don't believe there would have been any two-thirds ignorance rule back at that time. Starting about 1970, the teaching of civics went into decline from which it has never significantly recovered. The good news, I know simply from what I've learned in New Hampshire, is there are a lot of terrific civics teachers in New Hampshire who are trying to turn that around. One of their problems is that they don't necessarily have the material support to do it very well, and the demands on teaching, and this includes the demands that are imposed by the No Child Left Behind rule, makes it very difficult to find the time for more civics. But the reason I said that I think it is the most significant problem that we've got is that I think some of the aspects of current American government that people on both sides find frustrating are in part a function of the inability of people to understand how government can and should function. It is a product of civic ignorance. What I worry about is a remark that Benjamin Franklin made, and Susan Leahy quoted Jefferson at the beginning about how an ignorant people can never remain a free people. Democracy cannot survive too much ignorance. Franklin, in effect, had a comment to which the Jefferson comment is a kind of an answer or a response. And you probably have heard this, but it bears repeating. Franklin was asked by someone, I think, on the streets of Philadelphia shortly after the 1787 convention adjourned, what kind of government the Constitution would give us if it was adopted. And Franklin's famous answer was, a republic, if you can keep it. You can't keep it in ignorance. I don't worry about our losing republican government in the United States because I'm afraid of a foreign invasion. I don't worry about it because I think there is going to be a coup by the military, as has happened in some other places. What I worry about is that when problems are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible. And when the problems get bad enough, as they might do, for example, with another serious terrorist attack, as they might do with another financial meltdown, some one person will come forward and say, "Give me total power and I will solve this problem." That is how the Roman Republic fell. Augustus became emperor not because he arrested the Roman Senate. He became emperor because he promised that he would solve problems that were not being solved. If we know who is responsible, I have enough faith in the American people to demand performance from those responsible. If we don't know, we will stay away from the polls. We will not demand it. And the day will come when somebody will come forward and we and the government will, in effect, say, take the ball and run with it. Do what you have to do. That is the way democracy dies. And if something is not done to improve the level of civic knowledge, that is what you should worry about at night. So, to end where I began, the support of civic education in the United States, including in this state, is a public problem and a public responsibility which is second to none.
Do you believe that climate change is caused by carbon emissions by human activity?
The climate is changing, and the human activity contributes to that in some manner.
In some manner?
Yes, sir.
97% of the scientists believe that human activity is the fundamental reason we are seeing climate change. You disagree with that?
I believe the ability to measure with precision the degree of human activity's impact on the climate is subject to more debate on whether the climate is changing or whether human activity contributes to it.
Overwhelming majority of scientists say we have got to act boldly, and you're telling me that there needs to be more debate on this issue and that we should not be acting boldly.
No, Senator, as I've indicated, the climate is changing and human activity.
But you haven't told me why you think the climate is changing.
Well, Senator, the job of the administrator is to carry out the statutes as passed by this body and to
comply with. Why is the climate changing?
Senator, in response to the CO2 issue, the EPA administrator is constrained by statutes.
I'm asking your personal opinion.
My personal opinion is immaterial.
Oh, really? Your personal feelings about whether climate change is caused by human activity and carbon emissions is immaterial?
Senator, I've acknowledged to you that the human activity impacts the climate.
Impacts?
Yes.
Scientific community doesn't tell us it impacts. They say it is the cause of climate change. We have to transform our energy system. Do you believe we have to transform our energy system in order to protect the planet for future generations?
I believe the EPA has a very important role at regulating the emissions.
You didn't answer my question. Do you believe we have to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel?
Senator, I believe that the administrator has a very important role to perform in regulating CO2.
Despite the deniers, climate is changing. The temperatures are rising. The oceans are becoming more acidified. Habitats are under stress. The world is really facing this tremendous danger. And it's not about this or that politician. We're facing big oil. We're facing big financial structures that are at odds with the survivability of our world. And it'll be up to you as truth tellers, truth seekers, to mobilize all your efforts to fight back. And in California, we got plenty of lawyers. So we got the scientists, we got the lawyers, and we're ready to fight.
As it relates to your concern around gas prices, which I think are one of the most important issues in this state, in this nation, you have been fleeced by the oil companies. You have been screwed for decades and decades by the oil companies. Let me give you a proof point. Just 2 years ago, you were paying $2.61 more per gallon than the national average. The state didn't increase taxes, didn't increase fees, did not impose any new regulations. They took advantage of market conditions. That's exactly why we called a special session. That's why we followed up with a second, I'm not done, with a second special session to address the manipulation as it relates to how they manipulate the refinery market. So you're absolutely right, I care, so much so that we're actually calling them out. Big oil has been screwing you. And if you think big oil has your back, you got another thing coming. But there's not anything happening in 40 days. That's just all the BS these guys spew and you guys often report.
You've probably heard of food deserts, neighborhoods where affordable, fresh, and healthy food is hard to come by. The same thing happens in local news. A news desert is a geographic area with limited access to credible and comprehensive local news. News deserts are usually found in more rural, less wired parts of the United States. And with local papers and news stations shutting down left and right, these deserts are growing. It can leave Americans in a vacuum, oblivious to the full range of things going on in the world around them. You can imagine how much of an issue this was in 2020, with political division, social unrest, and a deadly pandemic ravaging the nation. How could people living in these remote areas get reliable, sometimes life-saving information that was specific to their needs, where they lived? And on the flip side, how were their stories and voices being heard?
The effects of news deserts, let's take it out of the political context and just talk about the effects of news deserts. What happens? Well, in news deserts, because you don't have a watchdog, you have more political corruption on average. You have higher taxes on average. You have lower bond ratings. You have a certain kind of social alienation and loss of, you know, community because no one's covering the high school sports or the obits or the community events or the things that, you know, are not major stories, but they kind of give a community some cohesion and coherence and common knowledge. So those things, when they disappear, which they do in news deserts, are disproportionately affecting Trump voters. And Trump voters are the very ones who should be working, you know, to do something about this phenomenon because they're the victims of it.
So this is not a battle of one day or one election. This is a long-term slog into the future. And you are there, the foot soldiers of change and understanding and scientific collaboration. It takes strong changes in business. It has tremendous political obstacles. Not easy. Well, we've proved in California that the economy grows. And it grows in part because of the climate rules that we've adopted. And we got more sun than you have oil. And we're going to use it. We're ready to ride the backlash back to sanity, sustainability, and truth. And together, we're going to make sure that California, as many states who wants to join, other countries, and ultimately Washington itself, will be together as we combat climate change now and into the future. You can't keep fighting reality. Fights are fun, and this fight is big, and I would say there's a lot smarter people in this room than there are in the climate denial community. So I have great confidence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor. This is the Bradcast 2025 Inauguration Counter-Programming Special. We'll be back.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Because there's a million things to be, you know that there are.
Welcome back to the Bradcast 2025 Inauguration Counter Programming Special. Don't worry, you're not missing a thing over there.
Would you be able to become president today?
Absolutely not. There's no way now for you to get the Democratic or Republican nomination without being able to raise $200 or $300 million or more. And I would not be inclined to do that, and I would not be capable of doing it. So that's, we've become now an oligarchy instead of a democracy. And I think that's been the worst damage to the basic moral and ethical standards of America's political system that I've ever seen in my life. And when you get to the Washington, you've already alienated Democrats from Republicans and Congress from the president. And we have red states and blue states. We never had any of that 25 or 30 years ago.
As President Trump comes into office, we have got to understand, and this is something I feel very strongly about, and it's not talked about enough.
We are moving rapidly into an oligarchic form of society. Never before in American history have so few billionaires, so few people had so much wealth and so much power. Never before has there been so much concentration of ownership, sector after sector, power of Wall Street. And never before in American history, and we better talk about this, have the people on top had so much political power. We can't go around the world saying, oh, well, you know, in Russia, Putin has an oligarchy. Well, we got an oligarchy here, too. And in this last election, in both parties, billionaires spent huge amounts of money to elect their candidates. You know, here in the state of Vermont, we believe we have town meetings, one person, one vote. That's democracy, not billionaires buying elections.
Our democracy is threatened whenever we take it for granted. All of us, regardless of party, should be throwing ourselves into the task of rebuilding our democratic institutions. When voting rates in America are some of the lowest among advanced democracies, we should be making it easier, not harder, to vote. When trust in our institutions is low, we should reduce the corrosive influence of money in our politics and insist on the principles of transparency and ethics in public service. When Congress is dysfunctional, we should draw our congressional districts to encourage politicians to cater to common sense and not rigid extremes. But remember, none of this happens on its own. All of this depends on our participation, on each of us accepting the responsibility of citizenship, regardless of which way the pendulum of power happens to be swinging. Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift. But it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We the people give it power. We the people give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make and the alliances that we forge. Whether or not we stand up for our freedoms, whether or not we respect and enforce the rule of law, that's up to us. That's what our democracy demands. It needs you. Not just when there's an election, not just when your own narrow interest is at stake, but over the full span of a lifetime. If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life. If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself. Show up. Dive in. Stay at it. Sometimes you'll win. I do have one final ask of you. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours. I'm asking you to hold fast to that faith written into our founding documents, that idea whispered by slaves and abolitionists, that spirit sung by immigrants and homesteaders and those who marched for justice, that creed reaffirmed by those who planted flags from foreign battlefields to the surface of the moon. a creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can.
I have no doubt that America is in a position to continue to succeed. That's why my farewell address tonight, I want to warn the country of some things that give me great concern. And then that's the dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra-wealthy people. And the dangerous consequences if their abuse of power is left unchecked. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. We see the consequences all across America, and we've seen it before, more than a century ago. But the American people stood up to the robber barons back then and busted the trusts. They didn't punish the wealthy. Just made the wealthy play by the rules everybody else had to. Workers want rights to earn their fair share. You know, they were dealt into the deal and helped put us on a path to building the largest middle class, the most prosperous century any nation in the world has ever seen. We've got to do that again.
Finally, new rules since this year's presidential race features both an unabashed socialist and a bona fide capitalist pig. Someone needs to explain to the free market solves everything crowd that when it comes to socialism, you're soaking in it. Marco Rubio says, if you want to live in a socialist country, why not move to a socialist country? Oh, you mean like Florida, where everyone's on Social Security? Yes, so many Americans hate the word socialism, but love the concept. Medicare, unemployment, disability, farm subsidies. Forget the transgender debate. What America really needs is a separate bathroom for welfare queens. You know, back in February, when democracy was still serious and Trump was still a joke, 66% of young people told pollsters that corporate America, quote, embodies everything that is wrong with America. And what side you're on in that debate is all about your generation. Older Americans are more religious, and America's real religion is capitalism. And like any religion, it needs a devil. And that devil has always been socialism. In 1961, Ronald Reagan said if we passed Medicare, we'd wind up telling our children what it was once was like in America when men were free. Thanks, Nostra dumbass. Republicans always think if you allow a little socialism, it'll spread out of control. But actually, it's the opposite. It's capitalism that we've let spread out of control. It's eaten our democracy. It's eating our middle class. It's eaten our healthcare system, our prison system, our news media. It's even eaten our food system so thoroughly that a lot of our food is no longer something that should be eaten. Because capitalism is a shark, or a tidal wave, or pond scum, or whatever metaphor you like to describe an unthinking force that devours everything in its path. And now the latest thing it is scarfing down is our national parks. The government announced they would be selling naming rights at the parks like we do at sports stadiums. Because the parks are $11 billion in debt, and since capitalism solves everything, cue corporate America, who's always asking one simple question, how can we help? Nothing in it for us. We just want to lend a hand. Like when Bill Cosby offers to help you with your modeling career. You know, when you're handing over national parks to corporations, when the price of a life-saving drug goes up 5,000% overnight, when our elections are being bought by the evil puppet from the Saw movies, It's time to realize we're better off if there are a few things that free market profiteers can't get their cloven hooves on. On the same day I read about the $11 billion the parks need, there was also this headline: $40 billion Air Force tanker program delayed. Because that's the problem with the Grand Canyon. It doesn't make Boeing rich. It just sits there, stupid canyon. I'm not arguing against the free market, just not for everything. It's funny, older people think socialism is capitalism's enemy, and younger people think it's capitalism's replacement, but they're both wrong. What socialism is capitalism's lap band, something to prevent it from eating everything. Don't let him do it. Don't let Trump live in your brain like RFK's worm. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't let him make you hate your family more than you do already. Look, we had an election. Trump will get the White House again, but this time, he's not going to get my mind.
My mind neither. Thanks for listening to the Bradcast 2025 Inauguration Counter-Programming Special. Don't worry, we'll be okay. Right? My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We take that charge very seriously here on the Bradcast every day. If you missed any portion of today's program or you want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me an email. I'd love to hear from you. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can also find me on the social medias, especially at Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. We'll be back tomorrow with another fresh Bradcast, come hell or high water, and I'm expecting plenty of each in the coming days. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.